Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was in Sacramento yesterday to announce a lawsuit against California over several state immigration laws protecting immigrants. Sessions also railed against Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf for putting out a warning about impending ICE raids in Northern California. In a four-day sweep that ended Wednesday, February 28th, ICE officers arrested 232 people from the Bay Area to Bakersfield. ICE said 800 more evaded arrest because of Mayor Schaaf's warning. On today's Your Call, we are talking about what happens after immigrants are arrested. Immigrants are held in detention prisons for an average of 13 months, according to the ACLU. Detainees often are not guaranteed a lawyer. They have the right to an attorney, but not at government expense. The Supreme Court recently ruled that immigrants, even those with permanent legal status, can be held indefinitely without getting a bond hearing. Immigrant rights groups say this is a victory for private prison companies. According to an NPR report, 70% of immigrants are detained in for-profit prisons. Joining us to discuss how immigrants are treated in these prisons are two guests. Francisco Ugarte heads the San Francisco Public Defender's Immigration Unit, which assigns public defenders to immigrants in deportation hearings. And Francisco joins us in studio. Hi, thank you for coming in.
Morning.
We're also joined by Rebecca Merton. She coordinates a national visitation network and is an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement. That's an organization devoted to abolishing the U.S. immigration detention system while ending the isolation of people suffering in this for-profit system. Rebecca also joins us in studio. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you for having us, Rose.
Let's talk about this recent ICE raid. ICE arrested 232 people from the Bay Area to Bakersfield. And during the sweep, the San Francisco Chronicle wrote a piece about some of these people. A construction worker, for example, in Merced County said he and his friends had been picking up coffee at a convenience store and run into ICE agents inside the store. They were approached and questioned outside the store by agents. Three of the workers were arrested. Two have already been deported. Rebecca, what else can you tell us about this recent ICE raid?
So what we've seen recently in the local detention facilities in Northern California is sort of a shift in the types of folks that they're bringing in. A lot of people who are now being detained don't have prior experiences with the criminal history system. This is their first time in a county jail, which is extremely distressing for them and their families. And a lot of them have long-standing ties to their communities. They have many kids in local schools. And while this isn't new, I think there is increased enforcement, in workplaces, at traffic stops, places where under previous administrations they were less common.
Francisco, what would you add?
Yes. Looking at the language that ICE uses, particularly under the Trump administration, but really historically, they use the word criminal as a pretext, as a predicate to do their dirty work and removing, non-citizens from the country or putting them in jail. And if you look at their definition of what the term criminal is, it wouldn't seem to equate with what we would think of when we think of that word criminal. They've defined criminal as anyone previously arrested on any criminal offense. That could be a traffic violation. They've also defined the word criminal as anyone who has committed acts which constitute a crime. And I would venture to guess every single adult human being in the United States would fall under that category. So the way they're building popular support for its mass deportation program is by asserting over and over again, repeating a very simple messaging, we're going after criminals, we're trying to keep this, the public safe, when in reality what they're doing is that they're undermining safety in the community, they're separating families, they're declaring war, essentially, on the very civic fabric of our communities. And It's a dangerous rhetoric. We've seen this kind of rhetoric happen throughout history. There's a very, very powerful concept of this idea of legality versus illegality. I think Richard Kunstler, a famous attorney, once said that, you know, if you look at history and all the worst egregious abuses, human rights abuses in the history of the world, the Holocaust, slavery, it's all under the guise of legality. And so that these heads of immigration understand that dichotomy, legal versus illegal, and they're using this term criminal to go after people. We represent about 85 detainees in the immigration detention facilities throughout Northern California. We met some of the people who were picked up, and I agree, you know, immigration is now going after people who weren't previously incarcerated.
Well, that's what I've been wondering, because if ICE over the course of 4 days arrested 232 people from the Bay Area to Bakersfield, but said 800 more evaded arrest, how are they deciding who to arrest and where to go? How are those decisions being made? Rebecca, do you know?
One thing we've seen across the country, and I'm concerned about taking place in the Bay Area, is the targeting of activists and people who have spoken out against this deportation machine. There are countless examples from Tacoma, Washington, to Texas, to recently Virginia, in New York City, where ICE is actively going after people without documents who have spoke out at rallies and vigils. And I'm concerned about some of my local friends, both who have been in the detention system and or have spoken out at rallies, because we're concerned that ICE, especially with the ramping up of language and rhetoric about people in California evading federal law, that they might start targeting these people specifically.
I think we don't know how they're making these decisions, because they're not telling us.
Right.
This is one of the least transparent organizations in the federal government. It could be a visa overstay. It could be someone who was in removal proceedings who missed a court date, could be someone with a prior DUI arrest driving under the influence of alcohol. It could be anything, really. We don't know. And that's also dangerous, because we simply don't know who their targets are. And when they say 800 people evaded arrest, they're not saying how they evaded arrest. They very well may have been in their own homes at the time, and ICE didn't go to their homes. In order to do an operation like this, you need hundreds and hundreds of ICE agents. You need to fly people in. You need a coordinated, long-term, investigation into individuals. So we're never really going to know how they target people. These are enforcement activities are kind of like shock and awe moments. Mm-hmm. The purpose is more to put fear into human beings and not to actually make arrests. Because if you look at the number of deportations that happen each year, we're looking at 300,000, 400,000, 120 or 200 is really not that many. That's like an average day for Immigration and Customs Enforcement. So a lot of this is messaging, is shock and awe. It's about trying to set an ideology within our country.
We've done a lot of shows about deportations under the Obama administration. Under that administration, there were more deportations than any other administration. We've talked a lot about how this administration is going after far more people. What are the differences between the Obama administration and the Trump administration when you look at how these arrests are being made and the methods that ICE is using?
In addition to the changes in the types of arrests that are being made that we've been discussing, the fact that they're picking people up at courthouses and sanctuary churches and spaces that under the Obama administration were identified as spaces that shouldn't be the sites of immigration enforcement activities, I would say a major shift under the Trump administration has been detention conditions and the blatant disregard to keep people detained in anything that could be called humane conditions. And they have really come out. They canceled the Office of Detention Oversight under ICE. They've explicitly said that they're not interested in overseeing the conditions in detention facilities around the country. And I think this is part of the larger efforts on the administration's part to put people in such terrible conditions that they're willing to agree to be deported as opposed to staying in these facilities and fighting their cases.
Let's talk about the conditions in just a minute. But before that, Francisco, what rights do immigrants have after they are arrested?
A lot. and that's really an unspoken reality that people in this country are not aware if they listen to the Trump administration rhetoric. I think the individuals who are arrested, who fight their case, the odds of them winning their case ultimately is up to 50 to 60% if they truly want to fight their case and are amenable to being detained for a long time. Some people get out of custody immediately. Sometimes ICE just releases someone on a bond or an electronic monitoring device. Other times, immigrants have to stay in custody about 3 weeks, a month, and fight to get out, go before an immigration judge to determine whether they're a danger to the community or flight risk. And a judge may or may not elect to set a bond. We've had about a 50% success rate of our detained clients who go at a bond proceeding. So there are rights to due process. There are rights to have a hearing. Some people don't have a right to go before an immigration judge. However, if you really litigate the case aggressively, you can usually get before a judge at some point in the proceeding. So, you know, the laws aren't exactly friendly to non-citizens. They're quite punishing. However, with able counsel and effective representation, non-citizens often do have a claim for relief and can win their cases. It's the detention that oftentimes undermines that, because who would want to be in jail for a year, you know, to fight your immigration case if that carrot of being released from custody and going back to where maybe a second cousin or a brother is in your home country? That's really the challenge that attorneys face.
Francisco Ugarte heads the San Francisco Public Defender's Immigration Unit, which assigns public defenders to immigrants in deportation hearings, currently representing 85 detainees. We're also joined today by Rebecca Merton. She coordinates a national visitation network and is an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement. That's an organization devoted to abolishing the U.S. immigration detention system. And if you'd like to join us today, we're talking about what happens after immigrants are arrested. What questions do you have about immigration prisons? Immigrant rights groups say the recent Supreme Court decision that immigrants, even those with permanent legal status, can be held indefinitely without getting a bond hearing is a victory for private prison companies. According to an NPR report, 70% of immigrants are detained in private for-profit prisons. If you or a family member have faced detention, maybe someone in your community, what rights did they have? How did you get informed of those rights? The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. We are live on the KALW Facebook page. You can leave us a message there or a question. You can tweet us at Your Call Radio or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. I want to make sure I have my numbers right. According to various reports, on any given day, there are about 50,000 immigrants in these prisons, and then 70% of those immigrants are detained in private for-profit prisons. Is that right, Rebecca?
I think it's, at this point, reaching 50,000, but it's definitely has been over 40,000 for a long time now. And in addition to that, almost 500,000 of people are in ICE detention at some point over the course of a year. And then I would also add, as we've been discussing, the right to legal counsel or lack of that right. 84% of immigrants in detention are not represented.
And why is that?
it is extremely difficult to retain a lawyer from inside ICE detention facilities. First of all, they don't have the right to even a free phone call after they're detained. That can sometimes occur with the discretion of the ICE official or deputy, but they don't have that right. And a lot of the people we see in detention have not even been able to inform their family members that they've been detained or where they are detained. And sometimes what we do on the outside is we will be the first ones to contact family members to let them know that their loved one is in detention. We have talked to family members abroad who have told us, you know, I thought that my husband or my son had been in a plane accident or, you know, had died crossing the desert. I just didn't know where he was, and that's extremely terrifying. Mm-hmm. In addition to that, a lot of people in immigration detention are stuck in their cells. They're unable to access the phone when they wish to try to make calls to attorneys. There was a recent settlement between the ACLU of Northern California in Northern California about the lack of phone access for people in immigration detention facilities in the area to be able to make calls to attorneys. And that settlement went into the enforcement phase in November, and we're monitoring these facilities to make sure that they're actually training the deputies about how to facilitate that access, because it's just so crucial. As Francisco has been talking about, it makes such a huge difference for people in detention and their cases whether or not they have legal representation.
You coordinate a national visitation network. And your visitation program with the facility in Richmond was shut down yesterday. Can you tell us how these visitation programs work?
Absolutely. So the visitation program we have at the West County Detention Facility in Richmond was a formal agreement with the sheriff's office there as well as the San Francisco ICE field office. This jail has one of the most restrictive visitation policies that I've ever seen. It requires an approved visitors list that people have to submit at the beginning of their detention and can only be changed once a year. And visits have to be prearranged by the person in detention, and then they have to relay that information to their family members on the outside, which is impossible to do if you can't afford the exorbitant phone calls that the private company that the facility contracts charges. So for a variety of reasons, it's really, really difficult for people in ICE detention there to receive visits even from their family members, let alone any community advocates who want to support them if they don't have family members or anyone on the outside to offer them assistance, which is why starting in 2011, we began a formal visitation program there where the facility granted us access to the visitation room once a week to meet with everyone there who wanted to meet with our volunteers. And we've built a really strong, amazing cohort of local volunteers and have built very close relationships with people detained at the facility. And I think the fact that we were facilitating letters and details about the abuses that people were suffering at the facility, we were relaying that information to the public, and for that reason, they decided to shut down our visitation program, which I think is extremely cruel to the people detained there. Already, I've been fielding calls as well as all of our local volunteers from people in the facility who are really distressed that we're not going to be there on Friday to meet with them and continue to help them with their cases.
Francisco, can anything be done about this legally?
Absolutely. You know, as an attorney, so I go to that detention facility often. I would say at least twice a week.
The one in Richmond?
Exactly, West County Detention Facility, which is an immigration prison. I, as an attorney, can get in there pretty easily, you know, 24/7 access, and it's pretty easy. But I don't think I've had one client that's been able to see a family member. And sometimes it's because of economic issues. Sometimes it's because, you know, it's located away from where families live. But if you really evaluate how to set up a visit, it's insane. You're asking a detainee to make a phone call, pay for their own phone call, to make a request to the sheriff for a visitation date. And then the detainee has to coordinate with the family when that visit will happen. I've been at the detention facility where someone is 1 minute late. Mm-hmm. 1 minute late. And they were not allowed to go in and visit with their family. And this is someone who hasn't seen, you know, their loved one for a month or so. Now, I got to say, my own experience is interesting because as a lawyer, I can go in at any time. So I personally don't see that. But it is a tremendous barrier for individuals in detention. And I think that when people hear about what has happened to your organization, there will be, you know, there will be a fight. They're not going to get away with preventing such level of access here. I want to talk about...
Can I just ask you quickly?
Sure.
If someone is a minute late and they cannot see their loved one, who's making these rules?
The sheriff, I would assume. The sheriff promulgates visitation rules, and it's under the power and authority of the elected official, who is the sheriff.
Have you seen them strengthen under this administration? I mean, is this common?
One thing I will add about this visitation policy is that in the contract that the facility has with ICE, they are supposed to follow the 2011 ICE National Detention Standards, which explicitly states that approved visitor lists cannot be required for people in ICE detention. It recognizes the vulnerability of that specific population because they might not even have someone on the outside that they could put on an approved visitors list, and they have to rely on community organizations like Civic to find those people to go in and visit them, and that access should be facilitated by these facilities. And I've spoken with the captain of the facility about the fact that this is a direct violation of the standards that the facility is supposed to be complying with per their $6 million annual contract. And essentially, her response was, I'm not going to change my jail. So the unfortunate aspect of that is that it's really up to ICE to ensure that they're following the ICE standards, and ICE oversight tends to be extremely perfunctory.
And on the phone call issue, too, it's important to understand the history of this. It used to be the case that there were no free phone calls and that you would have to pay this really essentially a corrupt telephone company I think they charge something like $1 a minute for a phone call. So as an attorney, you'd get a call and you'd hear a voicemail from some company that's pre-recorded saying, oh, you've received a call from a detention facility. If you wish to accept this call, press 1. You press 1. Please provide your credit card number. And then you provide the credit card number, and suddenly the bill is like $20, mm-hmm. $25 for a phone call to legal counsel that should be free. So there was a great lawsuit filed, and there was a settlement attached. Now detainees are allowed to make free phone calls. Attorneys can register for the list if they're pro bono attorneys, not private attorneys, but only pro bono attorneys. And you get a code. So you get a 4-digit code for a phone number. You give that code to your clients. Your clients then make a phone call to you. But it's very challenging for non-citizens sometimes who are monolingual Spanish speakers or who are really unfamiliar with the legal system in the United States and to make that call. And I've gotten maybe 3 clients to use that code, even though I've provided the code to every single one of my clients. But we're working on that. We're improving our practices. And thanks to organizations like Civic, we have a lot of public support to ensure more cohesive access to clients. Now, for criminal defendants, the telephone, I mean, not to say this is a bastion of human rights, but there are fewer barriers for people who are incarcerated for criminal offenses to contact their lawyers. I want to get back to your other question about why don't detainees have lawyers? Why is it 84%?
We're going to take a quick break.
Sure.
We do that right after the break. That is Francisco Ugarte. He heads the San Francisco Public Defender's Immigration Unit. They represent 85 detainees. Rebecca Merton coordinates a national visitation network and is an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement. And on today's Your Call, we are talking about what happens to immigrants after they are arrested and detained. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We will discuss coverage of a bipartisan push to roll back the 2010 Wall Street Reform Act. This week, the Senate voted 67-32 to dismantle major parts of that law. We will also talk about the White House decision to slap tariffs on steel and aluminum imports, and we'll discuss the victory of populist and far-right parties in Italy's election. And then on Monday, on our One Planet series, photographer and filmmaker Chris Jordan will discuss a new documentary called Albatross, a beautiful and very disturbing documentary about what's happening in the northern Hawaiian islands when it comes to plastic and how they're affecting the albatross. You can see that at the Ocean Film Festival, which kicks off today in San Francisco. We did a show about a couple other films on Monday. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, yourcall@kalw.org. Today we are talking about what happens to immigrants after they are arrested. About 50,000 immigrants wake up in prisons across the country every day. And according to NPR, 70% of immigrants are detained in private for-profit prisons. If you have any questions about these prisons, we'd love to hear from you, how immigrants are treated. If you are connected to someone who has faced detention, what was that experience like for you? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We're live on Facebook. You can find it at the KALW Facebook page and leave a comment there. Tweet us at Your Call Radio or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Rebecca Merton. She coordinates a national visitation network. In fact, the network in Richmond at the West County Detention Facility, that visitation program was just shut down yesterday. She's also an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement. Francisco Ugarte heads the San Francisco Public Defender's Immigration Unit, which assigns public defenders to immigrants in deportation hearings. They currently represent 85 detainees. Before the break, Francisco, you wanted to talk about the question I asked about why detainees don't have representation.
Yeah, I'd like to talk about that. Just to be mindful, interior immigration enforcement is a relatively recent phenomenon, this massive interior enforcement. Usually the enforcement historically has been at the border. So if you look at the detainee population, 50% or more have been in the United States for 10 years or longer. Another 50% have a U.S. citizen child. So you have mixed status families. So the people who have only been here for a short amount of time often do accept their removal and so don't end up in detention. That's just, you know, I would not say anecdotal, but a kind of broad generalization of the detention population. The immigration laws were drafted pre this mass deportation phenomena that we're seeing today. And so it used to be the case that, well, an immigrant didn't have a right to appointed counsel, but you didn't have the catastrophic mass incarceration that you have today. So there is no federal right to appointed counsel. If you can't afford a lawyer and you've been in jail for a year and you're fighting your deportation case in this extraordinarily complicated legal realm, the government will not give you a lawyer. And it's crazy because if you think about someone who's arrested on a trespass violation, who's out of custody, never seen a day in jail, they go to court, the government appoints a lawyer if they can't afford one. Yet someone facing life banishment, separation from their family, you know, these extraordinary stakes, the government doesn't afford counsel to an individual. So we're in this really a tremendous crisis in this country, a human rights crisis. We don't look at it like that, but this is a human rights crisis. 100 years from now, we're going to look back at these days as being some of the uglier times in our nation's history. So what states and localities are starting to realize, this is indeed a crisis. We should step up and solve this problem because we just can't imagine our own community members being incarcerated this long without a lawyer. County of San Francisco, Alameda County, the state of California, and New York City have all deeply invested into this concept of the right to counsel. Because as we said before, if you do have a lawyer, you actually have a decent chance of winning your case. And so our office Now we have four lawyers. We're about to get four more. We are, since the Trump election, we have been discharged with affording a right to counsel for non-citizens who are in detention. And the way our program works, we randomly staff courts. We don't have the wherewithal or the capacity to go to every courtroom at any time. We choose specific dates. We alternate between judges. We go into court, and we just take whatever cases are on the docket. And we offer our free legal services for individuals. And virtually always they accept our representation, and then we provide that representation. So we hope, you know, New York City is the first city in the country that started this, and they do have a public defender program. It's extraordinarily successful there. We were lucky enough to hire one of the managers of those programs named Jennifer Friedman, who is now in our office in San Francisco. We have four very talented, zealous lawyers in our office, and we hope to build upon that program here. And our, you know, the results are kind of interesting because, you know, we don't go into court and just say, oh, yeah, well, he's deportable. I don't think he wants to fight their case. We go in and we say, no, this person has a right to be here. He shouldn't be in jail, or she shouldn't be in jail. It's an egregious abuse of authority to confine this person who has one misdemeanor conviction, for example, to, you know, 2-3 weeks of detention or months. And we're trying to change things in the courts. It's hard. It's not easy. But because you don't get a jury in immigration proceedings, you get a judge who's under the employment of Jefferson Sessions, the attorney general. And so you imagine there are some pressures internally to be a little bit stricter nowadays. Mm-hmm. But we're going in. I mean, luckily, the bench in San Francisco, the immigration bench, they've been – many judges have a lot of years of experience and have been around the block. And so there are a lot of new judges too. But we're, you know, seeing some success. I mean, we don't win every case, unfortunately, but – you know, it's something that we're trying to do.
Can we talk more about the conditions? The facility that you were monitoring, Rebecca, the one in Richmond, the West County Detention Facility, immigrants have said that they are not let out of their cells to use the bathroom, and they have to relieve themselves into biohazard bags. Last year, Mother Jones reported that three immigrants died in 3 months in a private facility in California. Federal inspectors who visited found trash-strewn cells, moldy showers, broken phones, excessive use of solitary confinement, slimy, foul-smelling lunch meat. How common is this?
It's extremely common across the country, and we hear about certain types of abuses being particularly systemic. Medical neglect is a huge one. People may be detained in facilities such as West County, which is a county jail, for years, and they may be elderly. They may have special medical needs. And this is a jail that, on average, holds people, you know, for less than a month. It's not a jail that's equipped to offer medical care to people who are there for prolonged detention. And for that reason, people there have suffered really egregious medical neglect, very severe illnesses that aren't treated, denial of medications, virtually no mental health services, and that can be extremely troubling given sort of the emotional consequences of prolonged indefinite ICE detention when you don't know how long you'll be in jail, what will happen at the end of the sentence, if you'll be returned to your family or deported to a country where you may face persecution or even death, not being able to communicate with your family, being stuck in your cell for 20 hours a day. All of these things combine to create an environment where people suffer depression, they suffer anxiety, they suffer a sense of hopelessness, and they're not even given any access to professionals to support them. So medical neglect is a huge issue. Again, access to legal counsel is always something that we're fighting. Deputy harassment and abuse, including physical and sexual abuses, is a common occurrence, although it's not reported as much as it occurs because people are so scared of retaliation and they know that there is usually very little that will happen if they report it. Facilities tend to not review these allegations of abuse, or if they do, they almost always declare them unfounded. And people have been transferred to facilities far away from their loved ones and legal counsel as retaliation for speaking out, or they've been thrown into solitary confinement, or they've faced increased harassment from guards. So that, and in addition to sort of language barrier issues and the fact that deputies will encourage verbal as opposed to written grievances to prevent a paper trail, all these things combine to create a space where people feel like they don't have rights and that they don't have anyone to report the abuses they're suffering to, which is why community oversight is so crucial in these detention facilities.
And the three people who died in 3 months, Mother Jones had a long piece about this. This happened at the Adelanto Detention Facility, which is operated by the GEO Group. Mm-hmm. This is in the outer San Bernardino area in the high desert.
Yes.
Can you talk about, are there differences between, the, for example, the GEO Group, one of the largest private prisons in the country, and other facilities?
Yes. So the two major private prison companies that run immigration detention facilities in the country are GEO and Corrections Corporations of America, which actually just rebranded its name. But I would say that both facilities have their own, both types of facilities have their concerns. As I was saying earlier, county and city jails tend to be very limited in services that they can offer to people who will be there for the long term, because again, they're not designed for people to stay for 3 years. And I know people who have been at West County for 3 years with, you know, issues like needing to use a walker and then the walker breaks and isn't replaced for a year. We actually managed to get a man a new walker there because he had been using a broken walker for a year and he was elderly. The private facilities tend to be worse in a different way. Sometimes they have more services for prolonged detention because they really are designed to just incarcerate people for years and years on end. But they also tend to cut a lot of corners in terms of medical access, food quality, cleaning. You know, you're talking about these really unhygienic conditions. So neither are good.
Rebecca Merton coordinates a national visitation network and is an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement. They are devoted to abolishing the U.S. immigration detention system. We're also joined by Francisco Ugarte. He heads the San Francisco Public Defenders Immigration Unit, which assigns public defenders to immigrants in deportation hearings. They're currently representing 85 detainees. We have a number of questions from listeners. Roseanne says, I just want to point out that we are the ones paying for these private prisons. Somehow we've been convinced that this is a more urgent priority than, say, having schools in Oklahoma open for more than 4 days a week. We just did a show about how in Oklahoma schools are actually closed on Mondays because of massive budget cuts. According to NPR, ICE is spending about $2 billion a year on private prisons around the country.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I actually was recently reviewing the sheriff of Contra Costa County, his page for re-election this year, and I thought it was interesting that he says that one reason that his department contracts with ICE is to save taxpayers money because they receive money from ICE that they can use to spend on the local jail system. And it seems interesting. I'm not sure where he thinks the money that ICE is spending is coming from, if not taxpayers. So I thought that was ironic.
I had a client in 2016 that had been incarcerated at West County Detention Facility for about a year and a half. And one morning, an ICE agent woke him up and said, you're being transferred today. I wasn't notified. No, you know, his family wasn't notified, and suddenly I got a call from the ICE holding cell in San Francisco. I'm being transferred. Where are you being transferred? They say Louisiana. I said, what? And I talked to the deportation officer. They said, this is coming from above. It's coming from Washington, D.C. We have no say in this. So he's transferred, literally flown in an airplane with other detainees to Louisiana to a for-profit detention facility. The first two nights he was sent there, and apparently it was a quote-unquote bed space issue, but they don't tell us exactly why these decisions are made. He spent the night at this for-profit detention facility outside in Louisiana because there were problems, there were some kind of fight going on, and they didn't have enough beds to house people. And eventually he got a bed. We filed a federal lawsuit in the Northern District of California because it is illegal for immigration to intentionally subvert the attorney-client relationship, you know, when this person had a pending case. And so we filed a lawsuit. We got him out of custody. So ironically, it actually turned out better for the client. But it was my first foray into this Louisiana, these massive for-profit detention facilities, and the conditions were quite bad. You know, this brings to attention the lawsuit that Sessions just filed against California. One of the reasons they say California is obstructing the federal government, and we can go into that lawsuit about the federal government's ability to enforce immigration laws, is because California is requiring oversight, state oversight, of private detention facilities run by ICE that are operating in California. They are using that law to create oversight to the detention facilities as a means to say that California is defying federal law, which is really truly remarkable that they would have the audacity to say, we don't think it's legal for you to review detention conditions in your own state. But that's how ICE works. ICE is not transparent. They don't tell you where people are. They rely on secretive processes to do their dirty work.
Well, Mayor Libby Schaaf is now getting national attention for telling people that, according to her sources, there was going to be a crackdown. So now you have Sessions here yesterday, and state and local officials slammed him. Governor Jerry Brown said that his speech was a lie. We have a question from Matt who says, with any other kind of federal law enforcement action, it's hard to imagine local and state officials publicly trying to undermine them. Why do you think immigration is different?
Well, I think that's misapprehension of the role of state and local governments. I think unfortunately, the federal government under Trump has succeeded in painting this narrative about sanctuary policies as defying federal law, not following federal law. The opposite is true. The federal government is not following federal law by not getting warrants of arrest from a judge to take people into custody. What a sanctuary policy is a limitation on the use of local and state monies on engaging in federal immigration enforcement. That's what a sanctuary policy is. Somehow, the federal government has created this misunderstanding or this misapprehension that states and localities must spend their own money on a federal enforcement program. And so when a state elects not to enforce immigration laws, that should be within their prerogative as a sovereign that can elect to use its money how it wants to. It used to be the case that states and localities did cooperate with federal authorities because the crisis wasn't as extreme, that oftentimes the people transferred to ICE were only, you know, people who maybe had very serious criminal convictions or something like that. Secure Communities in 2010 started, and that was an Obama program that required sharing of information of anyone booked on any criminal offense to ICE. ICE would then send a detainer notice to a jail, which required then the jail under those old provisions to hold someone in custody and transfer them to immigration. That program created devastated communities, led to mass deportation. And so states and localities were like, hey, you say you're going after the worst of the worst, but the way this program is operating, you're going after survivors of domestic violence, crime victims, people who are supposed to appear in court, people on minor offenses. Why should we use our own money to help you do this? So the states have said, all right, sorry, we're not going to do this anymore. Suddenly, the feds consider this obstruction. It would be like me telling somebody, hey, get me some coffee. And they say, sorry, I don't want to get you coffee. Oh, you're obstructing my ability to drink coffee. You know, that it's not, it doesn't work that way. The way the legal system operates with sovereigns, competing sovereigns. And so it's quite audacious for the federal government to insist on states and localities to put millions and millions of dollars into enforcing a federal program.
We have just a couple minutes left, and I want to talk about how women specifically are treated. This is International Women's Day, mm-hmm. and there have been a number of reports about sexual assault. There was a lengthy piece in an online publication called The Outline, and let's see here. The number of complaints of physical and or sexual abuse made to the Department of Homeland Security between 2010 and 2016, 33,126. Rebecca, your organization also analyzed data obtained through a FOIA request for sexual assault data from the Department of Homeland Security.
Yes, and I'm glad you brought this up because at West County, which had the visitation program just shut down, one of the reasons we believe it was shut down is because a group of women at the facility started organizing and sent us a letter and a petition signed by approximately 30 of them back in November. And that's what got a lot of media attention to the conditions at the facility. And knowing the geography of the facility, it's incredible that they managed to do this because they are kept in their cells for 20 hours a day. And when they're out of their cells, they're under close deputy supervision. One woman who organized this, Nancy, has since been released and has continued to speak out about the conditions at the facility. Also taking place in Texas right now, at the Hutto Detention Facility, a woman there, Laura, was sexually abused by a guard. She had to continue to see the guard around. She also is the victim of sexual trauma in the country of origin, where she fled to come to the border and ask for asylum and was promptly thrown into this detention facility. As a result, she was in a very bad place. A nurse left her with a bottle full of pills, which she took and almost died. The facility threw her back into solitary confinement, told her that she would not be able to be released until she recanted the abuses. And then our affiliated visitation program there, Grassroots Leadership, has actually also had its access denied since they've been advocating for this woman's release. So we're seeing this across the country. A, the fact that women in these facilities are really leading this movement in organizing, and B, that the people on the outside who are trying to support them are getting their access cut off.
One woman in this outline piece, Laura Monterosa, mm-hmm. an immigrant detained at the Don Hutto Residential Center in Texas, who says she was assaulted by a guard, said, I didn't think that in the place where I was seeking refuge, mm-hmm. the same thing would happen as in my country.
Yeah, those are extremely powerful words. And we have to think about if the U.S. is supposed to be a beacon of sanctuary for people who are fleeing state-sanctioned violence in other countries, and then we reenact that violence within these detention facilities and re-traumatize the people who come to this country asking for help, you know, what are we actually trying to do with our immigration laws?
We have an email from Ruby who says, I continue to be outraged, saddened, fearful about our country's inhumane policies. We're sustainers of the ACLU and other lawyer-oriented nonprofits, but how can we help your guests? It's all we can do. We can't volunteer, but we can help with resources. She says, we're all in this life together. As long as I occupy my space, my sliver of time on the planet, I'm going to help those who need help as much as possible. That's why I'm educated, why I had a job that provided a retirement income. There are others who feel the way I do. What can we do to help?
Sounds like she's already helping. You know, there have been marches. Marches are impactful. The women's marches were really powerful. mobilizations, financial support to nonprofits. You know, there are so many organizations doing great work. I think that organizations like Civic, I don't believe you're a legal organization, but you're an empowerment organization. Mm-hmm. And I think Civic is doing some of the best work out there right now to highlight what incarceration means. We live in a society that incarcerates more people by far than any country in the world. It's really, truly remarkable. And in order to kind of change that, we all have a role to play. And language is important. How we talk about what incarceration is, how we use the word criminal when associating that with someone, the word illegal to refer to a person, but there's a ton we can do.
Just quickly, final thoughts on that question, what people can do?
Absolutely. In addition to volunteering, fundraising is really important for people in detention. They have bonds that they can't afford, and for that reason, they continue to languish in detention. So we do a lot of bond fundraising. We help people fundraise for legal services if they can't afford an attorney. We help families out whose primary breadwinner has been placed in detention. So if anyone's interested in contributing to those efforts, they can go to our website, endisolation.org, and donate.
To your point, Francisco, is it true, according to the outline, the minimum number of immigrants who must be detained in ICE facilities across the country per the Department of Homeland Security's, quote, detention bed quota is 34,000?
I believe that is correct, yes. Unbelievable that there's a requirement to detain people. Yeah.
How long is this supposed to last?
Well, until we get legal change. I mean, there, you know, when there's a built-in profit incentive to incarcerate, you know, then we've already made the mistake. So,
yeah.
Francisco Agarte heads the San Francisco Public Defender's Immigration Unit, which assigns public defenders to immigrants in deportation hearings. Rebecca Merton coordinates a visitation network and is an independent monitor for community initiatives for visiting immigrants in confinement or Civic. Francisco and Rebecca, thank you for coming in today. Thank you for your work.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.